The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to episode 20 of Unsound Methods with me, Lachlan Bloom.
And me, Jamie Batchian.
For those of you tuning in for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow authors of literary fiction about their process and technique.
So, for this introduction, at least, we are taking a stroll through the Olympic Park in East London.
Slightly windy, but very sunny. It's the first weekend of June and people are out and about. The sun.
Nice and hot. So yesterday was the hottest day of the year and the weather forecast was suggesting that today might be hotter, but I'm not buying it now. Yeah, this breeze is taking the heat out of the day.
It's either a good thing or a bad thing, depending how much of it is down to global warming.
I don't know if this is the podcast to be broaching exactly that subject.
No, especially as the recording of this podcast we were on in three different countries. I was in Australia back in February when we recorded it. Edie was in Norway.
And I was in London, so... Three countries that currently exist with the level of climate change, but, you know, watch this space.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to try to record a podcast with Edie over three different time zones. We had to get that quite aligned. And towards the end of the discussion, Edie suffered a power cut, so it was slightly curtailed, but I think we'd covered everything we wanted to talk about and we were wrapping up at the time anyway, so shouldn't be a problem.
Without any further ado, Edie Poppy, hope you enjoy the podcast. Thank you, Edie, for joining us on Unsound Methods.
Thank you.
If we could maybe start by talking about your writing routine, if you have one. Is there a sort of daily practice you have or regular practice in terms of your writing?
Well, I used to think about myself as a bohemian and to try to live the sort of writer myth. So I used to think one should have no routine and just live as it comes and write as it comes. And it took me actually very many years to realize that I actually love routine, or I love to have a plan. I love to go to bed with a plan. But I think my life or my way of writing changed a little bit before and after I got children, because before that I can write anytime, and then I mostly wrote at night and didn't realize that I love the morning. Now with children I have to get up so early because my time when they're in the kindergarten, like, that time is so holy for me. So I get up like at 6 and then really use every moment that they're away. And wow, the morning, it took me so long, but the morning is amazing. And the mind, when it's, you know, not been out all day and have a lot of impressions, or just sort of the pure mind, how can you say? Yeah, that mind works very well for me. And actually, also without, you know, the bottle of red wine that I used to think was, you know, necessary, I think coffee and water or milk or just the breakfast, it actually nourishes my crazy mind just as well as, or better than anything else. So basically my aim as well as a writer, since life is so busy and I also do other art projects, is really like, don't wait for inspiration. Like, inspiration comes when I open my computer. Like, I can basically write anywhere, anytime. But the favorite is the morning. But like, I can also not like stop with that. Like, I love to bring my work traveling as well. I think like writing is one of the artistic things that you can bring anywhere in the world. You know, you just need your computer. And so in a way, I feel also like, not obliged in a negative way, but I feel like I have to use that possibilities. You know, I have so many friends who are artists and they need their studios and they need like so many materials, and they also travel the world, but I really should do, and I have been doing a lot as well. So I also love how, you know, if I get stuck, then it also just helps to move a location a little bit. Could be like inside the same apartment, you know, from my desk to the window or to the kitchen table. But also, like, sometimes it really helps to move countries as well. So, yeah. And when my children, when I was on sick leave, no, not sick leave, but when my children, what do you call it, mother leave, like then it was really like, if, yeah, maternity leave, then it was really like, when they sleep, I write. So, yeah, so basically, I don't know if that that routine was going to grasp.
Do you think there's a change in what you write from switching from sort of writing in the evening, as you say, after a whole day of stimulus and experience, you're in a different state than first thing in the morning? Do you think the actual content or the style of what you write is affected by that, or do you have a plan before you sit down? Like at the moment when you're writing in the morning, when you come to open the computer, do you have any sort of plan in your head of what you might want to write that day, or does it generally sort of take you where it takes you?
I mean, it really depends of where I'm at in the process. I mean, in the beginning when I start to write, or, you know, I'm not the kind of writer who starts with a blank page and, oh, no, I'm going to write a novel. You know, that never happens. I'm a collector first, so I'm into something, into a theme, or normally it's something that I'm into myself, something that I'm somehow dealing with and find difficult or interesting or I haven't solved. Like, for instance, with my novel that just came out in the States and in the UK, then it was like I was in the middle of an open relationship and had a lot of questions and had no idea where my couple at that point would be heading. So I found it interesting to write about that and explore it as it was happening, you know. But then sometimes I had to wait for life to happen. So in the beginning, you know, I was collecting and sometimes it was slow. I spent many years writing this novel. But at one point, I kind of had all the material and then the job was more to, like, select it. Suddenly I discovered that the middle of the book was the beginning. You know, and at that point, when I have everything, then I can work much more systematic, you know. So there are all these different stages. I call it also like warm writing versus cold writing. You know, the warm writing is more just like I get an inspiration, I write it immediately and I don't judge it. And then sometimes I need a few hours, sometimes I need a few days, and sometimes I need a few years, you know, to be able to figure out, is there something here, you know, that depends.
Yeah. And wait, in that collecting phase, is it a case of sort of writing notes rather than anything longer? Just sort of something to aid your memory of an idea? Sort of like when you're writing about taking notes on backs of pieces of paper or on your phone, that sort of thing? Or is the warm period also sort of writing longer drafts of chapters and...
Yeah. It's basically things. All of that. Like now I'm writing on a new novel and I have like, I am thinking almost maybe 1,000 pages and there are a lot of scenes. Mostly there, it's a scene that comes to me and I capture it, but it's too fresh to judge, you know? So I don't, I think I will edit it later or I will cut away the half or I will know later if it was just an emotional outburst that has to do with me and not interesting for anybody else. Or if it's something that can become literature, you know, like that whole process, you know, what is personal, what is just for me, and what has a larger appeal can be interesting on a more on a more literary level, you know. And that takes a bit of, you know, to know what's good and bad in what you write is a really difficult task. And and I also need, you know, like everybody that writes, I think, needs the eyes of another. That's why we mostly have an editor, at least somebody else to confront your gaze with and to help you see better what you have done or haven't done or what's missing or what really worked.
And what stage do you, like, when does the editing process sort of creep into the writing? I mean, in the warm phase of writing while you're still collecting notes, are you also editing things down, or do you sort of wait until you've got a first draft before sort of critically going back and editing more seriously?
No, I think it depends. I don't think I have one method for any work. I think it really depends you know, that story or where I'm at. Like my first novel, Anatomy Monotony, I was writing it as my life was happening. So it was kind of slow, but I was trying to sort of, you know, I capture it and I went a bit further and then I went back again. So I always start with rereading what I wrote, because even if I'm inspired by my own life, the text still has its own life, which is another one that from me. So it goes from, starts with me, but then it gets its own, you know, its own logic. And then I have to look in the text for how to go further as well. So it's like this mixture of waiting for life to happen, but also waiting for the text to happen. And if I don't have an interesting voice in my, you know, if I don't have an interesting language that I like or that I find captures the story that I want to write, then I cannot go on, because the story, like, yeah. So I'm not the kind of writer who can write a really rough first draft, because I get too frustrated. I might spend a lot of time working something really nicely that I will delete. Well, that just has to happen then.
Was the voice quite intuitive for Anatomy Monotony? Is that something that you needed to sort of go back and really shape? Did that just feel like the sort of an honest sort of interior monologue that you had anyway?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, well, I found it interesting that to find a way of, you know, Vår or Ragnhild, she's like my alter ego. She has two names because there are like two books in that book. It's the book written in the first person where one is inside of the main character's head. But then she's writing about herself in the third person and has given herself another name. So those two stories have kind of two slightly different voices. So I had to find sort of both of those voices as well, the third person voice and the first person. But it took me a while before I realized that the book in the book should be written in the third person, for instance. So some things happen later, or that she should have my real name, for instance, my real birth name. But the first narrator voice was quite intuitive, yes. Mm-hmm. But still, still to make something look like it's written in 2 seconds might take 2 years, you know, like it's interesting this, you know, to make something feel really easy can sometimes take a lot of time.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about the sort of the three layers that there were effectively there, because it's, if you're writing it as a sort of auto-fiction, for want of a better word, and that character that you're using, that you're writing as, is then also writing, so it's like another layer, like the sort of the peel of an onion or something. It's a very interesting structure, I think.
Yeah, and they're writing about different periods because, you know, my novel in brackets starts like in London in the middle of an open relationship, and it's kind of a slow pace. You follow the character from day to day, more or less, in the here and now. But her story is happening in her childhood, and it's a, but even though the childhood was in a way very slow because she's from the countryside in Norway, nothing ever happens. But that past will slowly but surely catch up with the now, you know. So that has a much quicker pace. So it's like these two stories that at some point will cross, but, you know, with completely different speed.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And from this, the start of the project, was it something that was always going to be fiction? You sort of mentioned it started in a sense from your own life and your own exploration of what was happening around you. Did it ever occur to just try and write a straight autobiography as opposed to mixing elements of fiction in? Or what was the impetus to fictionalize elements as opposed to trying to be as quote, truthful in a sense about what was going on? What was the impetus to try and add elements that were not real, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think I had a bit of a sort of what you can call it, awakening sounds very pompous, but, you know, I was writing a kind of diary in the beginning, and then I reread my diary, and then I couldn't find my life in that diary. So I realized that the factual truth in brackets maybe didn't contain the emotional truth. So even if it was like factually correct, I didn't recognize my story. And I realized that sometimes you have to lie in order to get line brackets, you know, in order to get closer to its root. You have to get closer to how was the feeling and then create that world that can contain that feeling rather than how it actually is. And then on top of that, a life, how it actually is, it's too messy for literature. You know, you meet too many people. You have to kind of organize it and sort of cut away things to make it deep also, to make it sort of something that can be read, to make your life readable, you know. Mm-hmm. If not, your life is not readable. Like a conversation also is not readable unless it's a little bit like, you know, edited or made possible. I don't know if I explain myself well. But then on top of it, I lived a big part of my life in France before moving to London for many years as well. And I was really also inspired by, for instance, Marguerite Duras, this French Nouveau Roman writer. And I love the way she was using her life in fiction. So I also came from that kind of traditions. That was my school in a way. A lot of these French writers, long before I was, you know, Norway has now a cult of, you know, like Knausgård writing about his life and other writers writing about their life, but they were not my inspiration at all. It was more these, yeah, especially Marguerite Duras. She was a big, big influence to me.
How is the sort of Nouveau Roman scene in Norway? Because it's, I think, not a movement as such, but a group of writers that I find personally very sort of interesting and really have enjoyed discovering, I guess. But I think in Britain there's a sort of almost a slight suspicion about a lot of the things, especially things from the 60s, where people were trying to push the boundaries in a slightly self-conscious way. So did you find it through sort of Norwegian translations or anything originally, or was it when you moved to France and discovered them there?
Well, yeah, I discovered, well, I mean, my mother always, even though she's not a reader herself, but she was, you know, back in the days, you know, it was quite normal to be part of a book club and to get books through the post. I don't know how normal that is now, but my mother, she was like part of all the book clubs, and they kept coming books into the house where I was living in my farm. She never read them, but she always, you know, forgot to cancel. And then there came some Marguerite Duras books also into our house. So I kind of discovered her first in Norway, but really discovered her because I moved to France already at the age of 17. So, you know, my first reading of Duras was a very childish one maybe, but at 17, then she had a really big impact. But then later, only as an adult late in my life did I move back to Norway. And then I discovered that a lot of my colleagues, or that there is like a little movement, or a little, let's say that Duras has a lot of, you know, children in Scandinavia. Maybe also because she writes French in a very un-French way. You know, it's a very often very short sentences. Somebody could say she's a bit cold. I don't find that, but there is something Scandinavian maybe about Marguerite Duras somehow. And then also, of course, something very French in the subject matter, but in the style, it appeals a lot to a lot of Scandinavian writers.
You published your book originally in Norwegian in 2005. And you're now promoting it through the, through Dalkey Archive, putting it out in English. So that's a break of sort of 14 years. How does it feel revisiting something from, you know, from quite a while ago? And have you gone back through it and noticed things that you would like to have changed? Or do you feel that it's set and you're happy with that?
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, a book can, I mean, it's impossible to write a book that is completely perfect. Or if it is, then I guess you would never write another one. So there has to be like this little gap, but then still I think, you know, it represents me at a certain point as a writer, you know, and I wouldn't be able to write it now. So I'm so happy I wrote it then, you know, and that I captured this voice, my early 20s, which is also then these characters in her early 20s. And, you know, I'm thinking now I'm writing a sort of, I would guess it's a sort of sequel, but from my point of view now, when the character is much older, and then I'm, you know, in her 40s, and then I will I will have something new now and I will lose something that I had then. And I guess every book or every period in your life, you gain something and you lose something. And you will be a little bit frustrated and, you know, frustrated enough to keep writing, hopefully, you know, and not so frustrated that you stop. So I find it interesting to reread it also because, you know, even if I wrote it and even if the main character is inspired by me, you know, I can notice a lot of the other characters and have another approach now because I'm not so attached to it in the sort of sense that I just wrote it, you know. I can look at it almost like a cousin, you know, or a friend. And I like that book. I'm very proud of that book. And I'm so happy that I still like it. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to promote it, you know. Yeah. And I have no problems standing by her, you know. I spent a lot of time working on that book, and I am, my goal when I wrote it was that it would not be like a fashion item that you would wear and then find disgusting, but that it could stay there for a long time. So the fact that it got published, you know, in English, in American, 14 years later, that's a sign for me that it has some kind of value still. And actually, maybe I was just in Ireland promoting it. It was interesting because it suddenly occurred to me, for instance, that I wrote it before the internet was so big. And that the whole, you know, even if this is about sexuality and open relationships, it's before the whole internet dating system. And that's kind of interesting, you know, how that influences the story. So it has the kind of vintageness about it, you know, which I didn't think about when I wrote it, but which I notice now in the second reading. But at the same time, this internet thing that the book is not containing, but that has created an openness for people to experiment maybe more. You know, it's always been a little group experimenting, but now I think more people are experimenting. And so somehow the book might, in a way, gain a bigger audience now and be more relevant to more people than it was 14 years ago. So that will be interesting to figure out or to see what does it do.
Yeah, it's definitely a different landscape in terms of some of the themes that you talk about in the book today, exactly, as opposed to then. And going back to the sort of link with autobiography, is that something you feel in your writing is sort of intrinsic, that it when you're writing fiction, it sort of has to come from your life? And could you imagine sitting down and writing a work of pure fiction that was, you know, maybe related to themes in some loose way, but is more fantastical and, you know, purely fiction? You know, not Harry Potter perhaps, but, you know, something that is not grounded in real events in any way. Or is that something that you can't see yourself writing in that form?
Well, I have done already. I mean, it depends what you mean with using yourself or not, because I think even when you write something that looks more fictive, you know, you can put a lot of yourself in a fantastical story or in something that nobody would imagine has anything to do with you. But I have written, after my novel, I wrote a short story collection. And there it contains 7 stories. And there it's, okay, the theme is autobiographical. You know, it's about people, you know, leaving each other. And it's called, in English, it will be called Coming Apart. And it will be published next by Dalkey. But what I was interested in then, I was going through a divorce myself. And I was interested in myself and my husband's breakup, my ex-husband now, but also in everybody's breakup or in that sort of position, you know, like I find it so interesting that in a way, through a breakup, normal people can completely lose it, and it's in a way also acceptable. So that stage is so precarious, or I don't know, it's such an interesting thing, because also to really break down, you once probably were really in love as well. But anyway, what I wanted to say is that there are 7 stories there, and some of them are really not easy to track down how they would have anything to do with me personally. And I find that also interesting. But it has to be, at some level, something that triggers me, you know, something that makes me want to explore. And for instance, I went to Dungeness, and outside of, well, a bit outside of London. And I was so triggered by that landscape. I found it like the most crazy character. And so that story started from that landscape. And then the characters came. And that story is its own story. You know, it has in a way nothing to do with me, but it has a lot of my interests or my obsessions or in it.
And do you find the writing process is different when you're not... if you're not having to sort of collect so much beforehand, if it's just a simple impression of a landscape, and then you go on to write a short story, which is not based on your other experiences, is it a different writing process for that, or is it much the same as if you had spent a longer time collecting and refining your own experiences?
Okay. Yeah, that story, Dungeness, that I was just talking about, is like one of the longest, writing process. But it's actually possible to read it because Dolky has this Best European Fiction collections, and this one is in the 2015. Anyway, I spent maybe like even longer than writing my short story writing even longer than writing my novel writing that short story. But I would say I was collecting there as well, because even if it started with the landscape, I had to fill the landscape with meaning, with people, and in order to figure out those people and their journeys, I was collecting. And I used a lot of my experience living in Berlin actually and put it in Dungeness, you know. So sometimes it's quite surprising, you know. I needed them to move to Dungeness, and then I was just moving to Berlin, and then I could use a lot of that experience. Do you know what I mean? So something also happens unplanned. I would never say I would move to Berlin because I need inspiration for Dungeness, but then it happened, and then somehow I could use that. So I would say that every character I write, even the one who's inspired by me, it's a patchwork of everyone I ever met, you know. It's never just one character. And I'm in every character as well, somehow. And if I meet you, you will be in one of them as well.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying the show. If you have a moment, please do rate the podcast. Do you often have a dilemma in deciding which characters to use? I mean, you mentioned there how you used your experience in Berlin to fill the story in Dungeness. Did you have already ideas for characters before going to Berlin, and then you had to weigh up whether to use the new experience in Berlin versus the previous experience? And if you do have those sort of dilemmas, how do you go about deciding what is best for the story?
Well, actually, this Dungeness story is a funny journey, because I wrote it once as a sort of 4 or 5 page story that I published in a English magazine called Tank. I don't know if it's still existing, but anyway, it existed when I lived there. Tank, it's like a mixture between fashion and writing and architecture, and yeah. Anyway, I liked it a lot, this magazine. And then when I moved to Norway, my book came out, and someone said, you know, do you have a short story for us? We like your writing. We want to put you in an anthology. And I thought, oh, well, I will give them Dungeness. But it was in English, and I said, okay, I can translate this if you like it. So I started to translate it into Norwegian from English. And then as I was translating it, it started to grow. You know, it's like the translation opened up the story again. So it was unexpected. So we went from, you know, 4 pages, and in my short story collection, it almost became 50 pages, you know. So that was a sort of unexpected event. And then the anthology didn't happen, but my story kept going on for a few more years. And then I didn't know that this experience in Berlin would fit in there, or what came first, that my Berlin story gave me the idea that they would move. I don't know, like it got mixed up. But what I mean is that every story I write has in a way a I wouldn't say that I have one way of writing and I will always do it that way. I think I will always do it in a different way, and that's also why I want to keep writing, because I'm curious as how would I do it next time. You know, to find my way every time I think it's the best way to not write the same book every time as well. I mean, they might be have things in common. You can see it's the same writer, but still, you know, I want them to be different.
So, and does that writing, do you often find you sort of write one scene in multiple different ways then? Or is it when you sort of sit down to actually write the story or the novel, is it generally quite clear which pieces of experience that you've collected, which bits are going to slot in where? Or would you rewrite a scene in different ways until it feels right?
I think I'm a writer who's also like getting a lot lost. I'm not this kind of writer who really like gets a plan and then follows it. It's like I'm more like an explorer, like, you know, like I would go in the forest and I'd go, oh, let's look at this little path here and I will take it, and then it led nowhere. Okay, fuck, you know. And then I will take this other path and then, oh, here was really interesting. I would never have imagined. So I'm like this mixture between a writer and a reader when I write, you know. I have a kind of plan, or I have something at stake, but I don't know where it will go, at least not in the way that it's fixed. Like, there has to be some kind of, you know, that something has to happen in the moment I'm writing as well. And normally if I have a plan, you know, I get the feeling if I try to stick to the plan, I make it things too obvious. You know, because then I want the character to go a certain direction, and then everybody can see, like, you know, I make him like an autobahn, you know, I make like a very big like road. Oh, she's going down there. But if I'm myself more curious and exploring, then I think it becomes also a more interesting read. But what I did with Anatomie Monogenie, which I think in a way makes it, even if it's quite, it ended up being a long book. I always wanted to write a really, really short book, but it's kind of a long book, but it has very short chapters. And my goal in a way when I wrote it is that every chapter in a way should be something in itself. So in a way they are little story, they should all serve as their own little story. And I've heard from at least the journalists and people that have interviewed me that made the book almost into a page turner, you know, a surprising page turner. Like, the people were like spending the whole night reading it because this short chapter kept, you know, I take one more, and they all have a little twist at the end. So
I think that's definitely
that was true. A funny sort of discovery
that you want to just you flick over the page and think, well, okay, just one more bit, and yeah, it definitely leads you through, doesn't it? And that's quite a good strategy for.
Yeah, and in a way, it wasn't a strategy because I was writing really slowly all those pages, all those chapters. But then I realized myself when I reread it that it has this kind of surprisingly has a kind of, you know, page turner effect of not page turner maybe content, but it still made it into a. So those chapters, those little small chapters was maybe like, that's the structure that helped me, you know, to organize and to also select, you know, what wasn't good enough to stand as its own chapter went out.
And so would you have an idea of this sort of ratio of, do you end up writing to get one chapter that goes in? Do you sort of write that three times and two of them get not used, or... is it more a case of writing that chapter and then revising it until you're happy with it, but you know, you're not writing multiple chapters that don't end up in the novel at all?
Yeah, I also do that. I mean, I think I write a lot of material and then I try to find the novel in all that material. So it's a lot of deleting, a lot of like, oh, that goes out, that's got out, you know. And, you know, it's almost like if I wrote a stone and then, you know, I have this big material, I think it has some quality, but I have to figure out, you know, the face in the stone or something. Like, I have all this writing and now I have to find the story. It could go in five different directions maybe, and I have to find which one is my direction. But then what I do is that before it's completely finished, like in the end when I was finishing my novel and had, you know, over 300 pages and something, if I change one little thing on page 24, let's say, or added something to a character or took away a character, then I had to read the whole book again to see if it fitted, you know. So in the end, you know, your head is like a balloon, like a big thing, because you have to I was reading my book every day at the end of the process, you know, because every little change had to, because you can feel if you have new writing in old writing, you know, if there's suddenly a new writing, it stands out. And you have to get it to sit there inside and become one with the rest, you know. So, and I also read a lot of I read everything loud also. So in the end, when I could read through the whole novel and not stop, then I gave it away.
That's quite a good test.
Yeah.
If you can, there's nothing that jars you or pulls you out of it.
Yeah, so that's in a way the final, you know, the final thing. Read it loud, and but if you stop, then you have to start again, you know, and you have to continue till you don't stop. And then probably still not perfect, but that's the best. I guess that I came to, this is the best that I can make this book. If I continue now, then I will just make new mistakes, or I will, you know, this is it. This is what I can do. And now if I will go further or do something else, it has to be a new book. From here on, I will only destroy it. You know, this is it.
And going back to something you said earlier about the writing fiction to sort of explore the feelings as opposed to the sort of factual account of what happened and trying to get sort of deeper into the feelings. Do you, in the process of writing, do you ever sort of come up against your memory of how you felt versus another feeling that would maybe work for the novel, and you have to decide whether you write what you felt as truthfully as you can in the fiction, or write something else that conjures up a feeling but is maybe not the same feeling as you had at the time. I don't know if that makes sense, but is that...
Yeah, I'm more faithful to my real life than to my fiction in a way.
Mm.
Yeah, I would say that fiction gains because I'm a fictional writer in the end, you know. And so at the end of my book, I say, P.S., everything I've written is true apart from what I've invented. So I take the liberties I need. I mean, it's more important for me that I've written something important and interesting and that does something to you than the fact that it happened that way, of course.
Yeah, so if in your recollection you felt happy about a particular incident, but in the writing process you think, actually, if this character felt sad about this event, that would make the writing better. You would choose to make the character sad rather than to make the character happy yet.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And then I would maybe realize afterwards that, you know, that sadness that I put was maybe there at another point. You know, it's not so also so important for me that it's chronological truth. It's more like, is the feeling as a whole truthful, you know, but also truthful within fiction, you know. Do you believe in this story? And I find it interesting because what people, you know, if people would start to get on the trip, what happened to me for real or not, you know, they won't necessarily pick the right things. You know, there might be some things that really happened to me that people would think, well, that maybe you invented, and vice versa, you know. So, but anyway, it's not important. The important thing is, do you believe in this when you read it? Are you with the characters? Could this happen? In, you know, is this something? Are you living this? And also me. I mean, I forget in the end what happened to me for real because it's not important. It's a starting point. It's a sort of. It gives me details. It gives me a voice, but it's not important. Then I would just write my memoir, like you said. If that would be the main goal, then I wouldn't be a fictional writer.
So do you think that's distorted your recall of memories of things that actually happened, as it were, because you've made creative decisions when you remember things sometimes? Do you think that has distorted it?
I guess, I mean, it's interesting. If you go back to Marguerite Duras, she wrote the story, The Lover, three times. You know, she wrote three books based on the same story. And I guess maybe I could do the same. I mean, also remembering it from a different time. But there is also a memory within writing. So that story written in that perspective, from that angle, has that logic. But if I write it now from this angle I have now, it will have that logic. So, but I mean, doesn't everybody do it all the time anyway? I mean, we're constantly telling about our lives to each other, some kind of memory, and that way we tell it is shaping it. I chose to tell it from that point to you today and not that point. And that becomes part of my memory, you know, what I include, what I exclude. It's like editing is part of people's everyday life. People maybe they don't think about it, that they're doing it, but it's impossible to tell your whole life anyway. So you always make a selection. And the moment you made the selection, it's already fiction.
That's very true.
I think that's the interesting thing of where does fiction come in? Where is it a lie? Because, I mean, people in living their lives tell themselves stories with a large element of untruthfulness in certain ways to get them through the day and to create their self-image. But it's, you know, it's not seen as... that is just the way that people live. And I find that question of where the line lies between sort of making stuff up and just having a perspective on things, it is, there's no answer to it, I guess. But I think
truth is, in any way, in fiction or in reality, it's a very difficult question. I mean, what is it? I mean, if you have a crime or something, you have witnesses and how you remember it's so different. And still you're not trying to invent something maybe, but it's there is no objective, you know, very few things are objectively true or are true forever in one way. I mean, truth are also changing. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think the different, you know, with the crime, say that there's maybe CCTV footage or whatever, but when it comes to something like you're talking about, like a breakup, there's very little objective event happening. It's all happening within people's heads, and that's subject to being revised completely the next day, the next year, 20 years from then. And
you yourself, suddenly 20 years later, you might look at it completely differently because you have experienced something else that gave you access to another way of looking at it as well. You know, so memory, I find that fascinating. I mean, my book deals a lot with memory, and memory almost like a sort of living creature, because even if memory, one would say, happened to you, you know, memory is per definition something that has happened, still it's not fixed somehow, you know, because your entry to it keeps changing, and what you remember and the details. I find that so fascinating. Suddenly, you know, I can have a memory from my childhood that I didn't have for so many years, or why did it come to me now? Because of this event, then that comes. So things are also linked almost like in different chains, you know. That memory needs this thing to happen to come. And if it doesn't happen, you will never remember it again. But if this thing happened, you will remember that. And then if it doesn't happen, you wouldn't remember it, you know. So like a breakup, if you go through a new breakup, you will remember your old breakup maybe better. But if you never go through another breakup, maybe you will forget it altogether, you know, forget that feeling.
Yeah, I for me, that's one of the fascinating things about fiction, that interplay and how it lets writing and reading fiction, you're able to sort of get another perspective on the sort of fluidity of memory. Because I think for most people, most of the time, memory is just something that's there, like accessing their phone to get information. It's, you can recall stuff and it's fixed and it's solid and it's what happened, and you've got a chronological replay of what goes on. But when you sort of get into discussing it or writing about memory and these sort of topics, you realize just how fluid it is and how there is no real basis for either for any kind of statement on what did or didn't happen, other than the feelings that are there.
And I find it interesting as well, like even if you would record it and then you take a picture, you know, and then later you just thought you took a picture, but then you can say, you can see now, oh, that's a picture with a sort of, the film is from the 70s. One can see that, you know, when in the 70s, you thought it was just a picture, you know, just recording the colors as they were. And no, it was recording it in a 70s kind of filter, but you didn't know it, notice, you know. And I think it's the same now. One thing, one is just recording things. I mean, because one consciously can put on filters, you know, that's one thing. But on the other thing, one thing, when one doesn't, then it's a reality. But I'm sure later one will say, no, that was a really 2019 kind of reality, you know. And it wasn't actually like that. Or you thought you were acting normal. No, you were acting with all those influences, you know. You were not walking down that street normally at all. So I guess this thing, like a lot of things, you need distance to see things that you know think are invisible, are not. They have a marker, or they, you know, and then when you record an evening, let's say you film an evening, you can never film everything. So it's still what did you choose to film? It's still a point of view. So that's what I mean. Even when you just try to record a memory as basic as possible, you cannot get away from the fact that you are recording it, and you cannot to record it completely neutral. It's impossible.
Yeah. I think what fiction can do, though, sometimes is, I think you're right, that sort of marker of the time is always there in any writing. It's got something off the time it was written. But I think really good literature in brief flashes or moments can kind of somehow get beyond that into something timeless. And I mean, how that happens is a mystery. I think it's not, you can read a great book and have a sort of flash of something timeless, and reading it again in a different mood or a different time, it doesn't have the same resonance. But when fiction does go that little bit further, it does something quite magical that is hard to kind of access in other ways.
Well, yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, if you were talking about how fiction records memory, I think even if you always have that filter, you can still look. I read Marguerite Duras, and she has a filter, but she's still timeless. You know, she's still relevant, and I'm hoping that same goes with my book. I mean, I hope that's why it's out again, because even if it's written in the 90s, noughties, kind of, that, you know, still the themes or what the characters are going through, I'm hoping is still relevant, you know, like, even with that filter, it has other, you know, otherwise you can only read the books happening right now, you know, like, So that's, of course, the goal, to write something that, like I said at the beginning, something that is not out of fashion a year later, you know, something that stays and that you will keep returning to. At least for me, that's been so many years in everything I write, you know, at least that has to be one of the joys, that the writing can stay a bit.
Yeah.
There is one thing I wanted to ask. This is quite a tangent, but as you're... at least bilingual, you were speaking about how the Dungeness story you wrote was in English, and obviously you write in Norwegian as well. When you start writing something, how would you make the decision about the language that you would use for it? Was that just that Dungeness was in Britain, and, you know, English was the language in your mind at the time? Or,
well, I mean, I would say that French, English, and Norwegian are like my main languages. I speak a lot of other languages too, but those are like the three that I really, you know, master and that really form my personality. And I think all those three languages are always part of my writing, you know. But what was really special maybe with my life in London was that I was really consciously, I had sort of a double career. I was writing Anatomy Monotony in Norwegian, but at the same time, I was writing a poetry collection and a short story collection in English. And in a way, before I had my debut in Norway, I had published much more in English than I had in Norwegian. And I came to this point when I thought, you know, actually, fuck Norway, you know. If they don't want me, I don't want them either. I'm going to change my nationality and become English. And just, I love this language and I love to write in it. But just at that moment when I was thinking that, then my book got published and won a prize. And then I continued to write in Norwegian. But now with this, with my book coming out, and I just wrote an essay for the Irish Times in English, and I realized that I really also love to write in that language. And I love also the fact of writing in a foreign language. And somehow Norwegian for me also became a foreign language because I lived like half my life in other countries. So I think that approach of Norwegian as a foreign language inspired by writing in English, I mean, if this makes sense, is also part of my signature. And so at that point, it was very conscious that Dungeness was written in English. So my short story collection, which is the next thing that comes out, is a funny mix because I had written a lot of the short stories in English, then translated them to Norwegian. And as I did that, they expanded, all of them, and became a sort of collaboration between myself in my 20s and myself in my 30s, and now back again to English. So it goes through a lot of layers, but I found that really interesting. But then apart from that, French was a language that really shaped the writing of Anatomy Monotony, because I came there as a 17-year-old and very shy, very uptight, absolutely had no vocabulary for my sexuality. And then I moved to the south of France and into the French language, which had so much vocabulary for my sexuality. And that opened me. That opened the way I was thinking. And somehow I had to capture that and put it back into Norwegian.
So that was Edie Poppy. Thank you to her for joining us, and thank you for listening.
You can find us online at unsoundmethods.co.uk or on Twitter at unsoundmethods. And you can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com or at lachlanbloom on Twitter.
You can find out a little bit more about me on my website, which is jamiebatchen.com. Or I'm on Twitter at Jamie Batchen, or Instagram now at Jamie_Batchen, obviously with my weird spelling of Jamie. Thanks for listening. Take care. See you next time.
Goodbye.